Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
With us, another history maker. She is the first female mayor of Atlanta. And Shirley Clark Franklin, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me. And I certainly enjoyed hearing even just a small part of John's speech.
Talk about that, Cheryl. A lot of people did not know. When you were elected, Maynard said that, look, you know, and even Andy, really, that you were more qualified. I think it was Andy that said you were more qualified to run the city than even he was. Many people didn't know you had spent many years working in the Jackson in Young administration. Tell us your earliest days of City Hall work, and how did you come to first know the man we call Congressman John Lewis?
I moved to Atlanta in 1972 from Alabama. I was teaching at Talladega College, social science and political science. And I met some of the members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who were actually working in Alabama. And my first occasion to meet Maynard Jackson was, he was a young man in 1960s, late 60s, and he came over to speak to a history class and to talk about his vision of running for mayor of the city of Atlanta. In 72, I moved to Atlanta, and Andrew Young was running for Congress for the second time, and I was part of the field crew. Most people who know me think that I probably worked in the office, but I actually was part of the field crew that went out every day, knocking on doors, standing on street corners, talking to people and encouraging them to register and then vote. And it's in that situation that I met Reverend James Orange and Gordon Sellers and Reverend Langford. The ground crew, exactly. And out of that, I started having interaction and being in the audience mostly when historic figures like Julian Bond and John Lewis were around. But the first time I heard John Lewis, I was 18, so this would have been 6 years earlier, 7 years earlier, when I attended the March on Washington with my mother and cousins and aunts. So I was there for that speech, and I, as were several hundred thousand people, white and black, young and old, labor, non-labor, of faith leaders. And frankly, leading up to the march, I was most excited about hearing Congressman Lewis because he was young, he was vibrant, and he spoke with the kind of fire and power of urgency that so many young people felt at the time. But I did not meet him then. I did not meet him until I moved to Atlanta and then really got to know him best when he ran for Congress, for the city council, and served on the Atlanta City Council when Andy was mayor. And that's when I got to know him best.
Even at the March on Washington, he was the most controversial figure because they were White House, everybody. First of all, they thought we'd come into Washington, D.C. to tear the place up, as they always said. But they wanted to know what John was going to say. Did you have any sense of the controversy that was kind of going on that we now know is a part of the historic record, that this young firebrand, they wouldn't, of all the people, they weren't concerned about what King might said. They weren't all that concerned about A. Philip Randolph or some of the others. They won't know what has John Lewis got on that paper.
They were very concerned. And though we didn't have the internet and the forms of communication today, remember now there were several secretary or formerly Stokely Carmichael was at Howard.
Right.
Cleve Sellers was at Howard. I knew them both as students.
Wow.
I went to briefings that they gave. So I had a better sense of, they were more accessible to me at 17 and 18 when I went to college than FCLC would be, because those were older people.
Yeah.
They tended to be pastors and ministers. So so I was much more familiar with what younger people were. And they were pretty fired up. They were willing to not just talk about what they would do, but they would, this would have been 19, mm-hmm. I went to college in 63,
mm-hmm.
in January of 63. So I had been in school for 7 months by the time of March, 8 months by the time of the March on Washington. So we all knew that John would be fiery. We used the words, and he used the words revolution. In other words, changing things dramatically. Not fixing them from the edges, but literally transforming America into a fair, equitable place that recognizes the values and the aspirations of African Americans and others. And he ended up, as I understand it, changing his call to action because Dr. King asked him to. And the quote that I have is, he changed it. He could not say no to Dr. King. This was the man I admired and loved, and he was my inspiration, my hero. So he did change it to be a little less
radical,
fiery,
mm-hmm.
and called for marches all over the South. And if, in fact, the government didn't answer.
Yeah. I think he was saying he would we march from Atlanta like Sherman did. I think the line ended up
there.
You're right. That's the line they wanted him to take out.
And he took it out.
He did remove. Madam Mayor, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want you to talk about his city council days and the John Lewis you came to know. And then you decide you wanted to it was time for you to run for mayor. Did you call on him? Talk about your mayoralship days and the roles and the conversations that you had with John leading up and throughout those years, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Again, our special guest is Shirley Franklin. She in the movement now. She was not distant from it and came to know John as a friend, a city council person, and ultimately as the congressman from the 5th Congressional District. We'll be back in a moment. It's News and Talk, 1380 WLK. I mean, you knew John. That was from The View maybe a year or so ago. I don't remember. He actually believed that. A lot of us say those nice words, right? But we don't. We tell them that I believe all you just said, but don't hit me now. You from Philadelphia, I'm from South Atlanta. I remember you tell, look here, don't get too close to me. You tell the certain reporter one time. I still laugh about that. That's funny to me. I know you remember that day. You say, hold on now. I am from Philadelphia. And then you got to remind these people now, I ain't just no pushover now. Don't push me, but ain't no pushover. John absolutely believed and the power of nonviolence throughout his life. I never got the sense that it was just a tactic for him. It was a way of life.
I heard Congressman Clyburn talk about this because they were young students in the movement together at 20 years old. As you know, Representative Clyburn is from South Carolina.
Yeah, great guy.
And he said that he met John when they were both 20. Now, John had been active even before that. But
17.
They met at 20.
He walked away from his house,
Congressman Clyburn said, John didn't just use the words, he lived his life that way. What's amazing is that he decided this at 15 years old.
Yeah.
And he decided these were the principles. He had a chance to meet Dr. King.
Right.
I think at 18 and Rosa Parks at 17.
Yeah.
And he was committed to it. He wasn't recruited. His parents didn't take him. His teachers didn't talk about it.
Right.
He felt this in his heart. And I think that's what we all take from John, which is this level of commitment and passion for what is right and for love and humanity and peace.
Totally
you couldn't know
out.
John Lewis and not understand that. You can't read about him and not understand that. And I had no idea at 18, as a student at Howard University at the March on Washington, that I would move to Atlanta and get to know John Lewis.
Yeah.
I had no idea. But it is a sign that once I came and had a chance to get to know him and Maynard Jackson and Andy Young and Dorothy Cotton and Connie Curry and others.
Right.
You really do set a different standard for yourself.
Yeah.
I will never be, able to do what John and many others were able to accomplish. But my goal is to do my little part as often as I can. And that comes really from the direct inspiration of John Lewis. Here he is in a rural community, a farming community, and he saw a better world. He saw a better world, and he was determined to create it. And as a city council member, John was someone who stood on principle.
Oh, yeah.
As a staff member, I could give you all sorts of reasons why one piece of legislation was better than another, but if it didn't match with John's principle, there was no way John was going to do anything other than speak his mind, try to persuade the other council members, and vote his conscience. He was a man of conscience. And I recall several, when John decided to speak on council, the building shook, not because of the volume, but because of the weight of the principles and the theory that he would bring to an argument. So he believed in participatory democracy. We have a representative democracy in that we elect our leaders, but he believed that needed to be married with participatory democracy. And if he made a commitment on how he felt and how he was going to vote, there was no changing him. No changing him. No pleading, no begging, no you're the last vote, none of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to respect the conviction that he brought to his leadership.
You get ready to run for mayor. Do you seek out his counsel? Do y'all talk?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely seek out his counsel. And he was very willing to give me a example. As I was reading about his speech in Washington, he's saying, here he is, 23, all of these very accomplished leaders who have spoken and presented. And he says, I stood up, I said to myself, this is it. I looked straight out and I started speaking. Well, he and I were at the IBEW building downtown Atlanta for my campaign, and there was singing and chanting And I was getting a little nervous. Believe it or not, I'm pretty shy. I know nobody believes that, but I was, if I'm not now. And he whispered to me, he said, just stand up and start speaking. Same thing he did himself. Mm-hmm. So he was a great teacher. He didn't try to tell me what to say,
right,
or how to say it. He encouraged me to be authentic and honest and straightforward. And there is, I mean, I cannot think of a time that I didn't reach out to him, right, that I reached out to him, whether it was about affordable housing or transportation or some issue related to the city when I was either working for Mayor Young and Mayor Jackson, or during my term of office, that he would not at least listen to what was offered. And on occasion, he would call me and say he had an opinion, and that opinion, I think you and I talked about that, mm-hmm, around the extension of the contract of Maria Carstarson.
Right, I remember, yes. Yeah.
Many people believed or thought that I or someone else had instigated that. Well, John actually made the call to me.
Certainly.
He called me himself and said, this is something I want to do. Will you join me?
Yeah.
And we don't have to revisit that. But my point is, he acted out of conviction.
Yeah. No doubt. You always got the sense that it was principle. That's why I just... I had a different opinion, but I just shut up. I didn't talk about it that much, because after y'all said, I said, look, whatever's going to be, going to be. What are you going to miss about his friendship or his mentorship to some greater or less extent? What will you miss about him?
Oh, my gracious. He's kind of a guidepost.
Yeah.
He was always a guidepost on the issues. I mean, he could... He would synthesize a really complicated issue, mm-hmm, and he was a guidepost. And I didn't have to talk to him directly,
mm-hmm,
but occasionally when I did or talk with his staff just to get a sense of where he was on an issue. He was a guidepost. But the good thing about John, he was so consistent for so long, I think we can still use him as a guidepost.
Yeah.
In addition to that, he liked to have a good time, a good laugh. He liked, mm-hmm, to dance. Mm-hmm. I also will miss, he was a perfect example of having power and influence and being humble.
Yeah.
The humility he brought to his work, you'd have to know who he was and what, mm-hmm, he's done and what he's endured and what he's sacrificed, because he would never tell you that.
Right. So true.
He did not wear his honors on his chest. He did not boast about them. And I know that life begins and ends. And it's so hard to lose someone that you love and someone who's loved you or supported you and taken care of you. Right. But I've learned through the years that you have to live in the memories and you have to relive it and stay in that space and not put them, those who passed on, not put them in a box somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
So he will live in my memories and in my life for a long, long time.
Madam Mayor, thank you for everything. Thank you for your service. Thank you for continuing to serve. We appreciate you. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, okay?
And you can call me anytime. Thank you so much, Derek.
All right.
News and talk.
There you go. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be the USA Today this morning. Y'all know I don't get up before 11 o'clock, so I was up early, 6:30, 7 o'clock, reading, and picked up the newspaper. And it read from Montgomery, Alabama. Valda Harris Montgomery was 13 when John Lewis showed up in the wee hours of the morning at her parents' home, beaten, blooded, exhausted, and looking for refuge from a white mob. Her parents opened the door to their home. She remembers Lewis and other freedom riders walking through the hallway, collapsing in the kitchen. She didn't know why they were there or what they were, or what they had been attacked or when they had arrived in the city while trying to integrate the interstate bus system or the crowd that pinned them down overnight in a nearby church until the federal troops arrived. Our special guest is Dr. Valda Harris Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery, how are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
I am so honored to have you. Now, you heard, I have, my audience know, Bozeman do not get up before 11 o'clock. And you and I was up texting together this morning about, I know it had to be about 8:30. I probably
right.
read the article, and I said, let me just go on Facebook and try to find Dr. Montgomery, because this is an absolute fascinating story. And I found you immediately, sent you a message, and within 30 minutes, you were texting me back, and within an hour, we were on the phone laughing and talking and remembering this icon of a man. Your mother, tell us the story. Walk us through, Dr. Montgomery. How did your family come to know John? But first, your family is immersed in the history of everything kind of civil rights related in Montgomery. Tell us about your family first, where you live, who lived near you, and the people you met, and how did you come to know this young man, this Fiskite, who would later be identified to the world as Congressman John Lewis?
Wow. Well, let me start first by saying, identifying the neighborhood that I grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. It's called Centennial Hill, and it was the affluent African-American neighborhood at that time. And actually, my great-grandfather was an Alabama state senator. His name was John William Jones, and he was Alabama state senator during the Reconstruction period, so he owned a lot of that property in that area, especially on South Jackson Street and the High Street area. It was no surprise that the Dexter Avenue Street Parsonage would also be built in that area, which happened to be two doors down from where I grew up and where I lived. So anybody that was assigned to be the minister of Dexter Church would live in that house. And when I was a very little girl, it was Vernon Johns, and he left, and then the new couple moved in, and the new couple was Martin Luther King and Coretta King. So he was 26 years old at that time, no children. And that's how I became acquainted with the Kings, Martin Luther King as a young girl. And, of course, then our families were together as far as socialization and everything else was concerned. My dad was a pharmacist. He owned one of the oldest black drugstores in the city. And he was an ardent race man, as they describe mm-hmm. him. So yeah. It was not a surprise that when the Montgomery bus boycott kicked off that he did not get involved. And he was responsible for organizing transportation. And because he was a Tuskegee Airman, they said he talked in code while he's dispatching these cars back and forth at the same time he's filling the prescriptions. So let's just fast forward. That's in 1955. And, you know, everybody pretty much knows the story of the bus boycott and the chaos and the bombings and things that we had to go through. And so in 1961, in May, May 20th to be exact, when the group came in from Nashville, the Freedom Ride group came in from Nashville to the Greyhound bus station, and were surrounded by this huge mob as soon as they got off the bus. John Lewis was one of those that was severely attacked with a Coca-Cola crate, the metal part of it, that actually cut through his head. Mm. And so it was my father, some of my father's medical friends that were responsible for helping to patch him up. So that was their first introduction to him. At that time, the Freedom Riders scattered and were brought back together again for a mass meeting at First Baptist Church, and I always say the Black First Baptist Church, on Ripley mm-hmm. Street. And this same mob surrounded the church, and it was about 1,500 people also in the church. It was a mass meeting of sort. and you had your leaders that were in there, which were Farmer and King and Abernathy, right. et cetera. So this mob surrounds the church and holds all of these people and the rioters hostage, pretty much. And Reverend King was went down to the, he was in the basement, and he called Robert
John
Kennedy.
F. Yeah, right, Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, who was the Attorney General, and federalized the troops, and the National Guard came and picked up the Freedom Riders and brought them to our house in the wee hours of the morning. And that's how I met John Lewis. But as was stated earlier, it wasn't like you could say, hey, that's John Lewis, because nobody really knew who John Lewis was. He was just one of the Freedom Riders at that time. And they were all from, you know, college students. So this was pretty normal for us. So, but that was how we came to know him when he first came into the house with a group of Freedom Riders seeking refuge and just a safe place.
Talk about that, you know, you kind of went through that history, just breezed through it, but the Dexter Avenue Parsonage is two doors down from you. That's what Dr. King and Coretta, when he gets called to the pastorate to Dexter Avenue, right. Abernathy is in Montgomery, I think, at the time, at another church or nearby in the area. So he gets called, and all of a sudden, the story says they showed up late at night, but you always expect them because your family had been so involved in movement activity that you were not surprised at all to see. How many people end up actually inside y'all's home?
It was actually well over 33, but very close to that number. We usually use that number because that was the number headcount that we did. And that was the students as well. So one of those things that once the riders, those group of riders were in the house, you'll hear Bernard Lafayette and some of the other riders always using singing a song saying buses are coming. And that's pretty much what happened. It wasn't so much buses coming, but carloads of people, Freedom Riders, start piling into Montgomery and coming to, quote, the safe house. So the number count continued to grow, and that was where they had a lot of the strategy sessions along with the real leaders, which were Martin Luther King and James Farmer, C.T. Vivian, Fred Shuttlesworth, et cetera. I hope I'm not missing anybody. James Lawson, et cetera. And so, you know, that was just the place for them to gather, to feel safe, to unwind, to relax. I mean, you have to really think about what they had just been through.
Trauma
and just beaten and just no place to just lay your head down and just relax and sleep and plan and think and eat. And so... Yeah, this was what was provided for them by my parents.
And when we come back, we got to take a break. When we come back, talk about your dad is a doctor, a physician. He stitches.
He's a pharmacist.
So he
like the Black Medical Group.
Right. You know, so he calls, say, "Look, I got a couple of these boys over
there
here. Got the head busted up. Somebody come over here and stitch up the head, and you know, bring some." Ice packs for contusions, and so he would call on the, you know, the other doctors or professionals in there. They will come and just take care of them. And we'll come back. I want to tell you about feeding them, because you told me earlier today that another, was it your uncle that had the random kind of cafe? And
he had a restaurant. Yes.
Okay.
He had a restaurant.
All right. When we come back, I want you to tell us that part of the story, and then tell us about the special relationship. Your mother transitioned from earth to glory, but she would get a visitor from time to time who would come check on her. And
That's
I want you to tell us about that and what that meant to her and what that meant to your family, okay?
Okay.
Our special guest is Dr. Valda Harris Montgomery, and she's from Montgomery, Alabama, and... in the wee hours of the morning, 20-something, 21, 22-year-old John Lewis shows up at her door and knocking and asking, we've been beat on this bus, this Freedom Ride. Can we come in? And they said, sure. In Montgomery, I can't wait to get down there to meet her in person. Dr. Valda Harris Montgomery, a distinguished educator in her own right, come from a family of givers. Dr. Montgomery, did your family had a lot on the line. They had wealth, they had means. They were business owners, so it gave them some level of independence. Did you see anything that they were doing at that time as dangerous? Because still, the mob, they didn't care whether you had resources or not. They were bombing and doing everything else in Montgomery and Birmingham and other places in Alabama. Did y'all ever get any pushback from helping these students?
Well, first let me clarify something that you said earlier before the break, and that was when John Lewis came to the house, because I don't want to paint a picture that he just showed up and knocked on the door and let him in. The National Guard brought all of them there. They loaded them up on jeeps in the car and brought them in. So it was a group of them coming in at one time during the wee hours of the morning. And in fact, he writes about that in his book, Walking with the Wind.
Yeah.
And if anyone has that copy, if you look at Dean, calls my dad Dean Harris, even though my dad's name was mm-hmm. Richard. He calls him Dean Harris because the drugstore was Dean Drugstore. But you'll see mm-hmm. that part where he was talking to him, and especially the part about my dad giving him his first beer. That was our running yeah. joke. But mm-hmm. Nonetheless, you were asking about the fear. And from a child standpoint, and when I say child, I mean mm-hmm. child growing into a teenager, that is a question that's often asked of us, meaning my sister and my generation, and here in Montgomery. And fear was never an issue. You never wow. felt fear. You never felt afraid. There was always that faith, and the solidarity of black people was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever be able to recreate that again. But then again, here comes Black Lives Matter,
yeah.
which is, we're so excited about that because we haven't seen that kind of passion mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. camaraderie
right.
for me since the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
But as far as the pushback and all is concerned, we never felt it. We as the children never
right,
felt it.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that it wasn't there.
Right.
You see, yeah. Mama never said
shielded it. Shielded from, I'm sure.
Very much
they
so.
Didn't just let y'all just help people like that, you know.
No.
Were monitoring King and, you know, and the airway went. Talk a little bit about, John develops a relationship with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about he would come back. To just see her and check on her. Talk
mm-hmm.
talk a little bit about that relationship, what it meant to your mom and what it meant to your family, that he didn't forget you all.
No, he didn't. He didn't forget. I can honestly say that. I can say, however, that as he, you know, became more the responsibilities that he had to take kind of came into his time frame, so he wasn't able to visit like you would think a person would be able to do. But when they had the 45th anniversary of the Freedom Riders, and all the Freedom Riders, quite a number of them came back. There was an unveiling of a marker that he helped to put in front of our home that talks about the story and the Freedom Riders that were there, and just giving pretty much homage to my parents and to the house. And he came to speak and to unveil. And when asked by the news person about my mom, he was standing next to my mom. He mentioned how courageous she was, how courageous mm-hmm. the family was to actually, as you said, to open up their home, not knowing what could possibly have happened to them.
Right.
And that was when I really realized how important my parents were, because, mm-hmm. you know, when you're growing up, that's just your mom and daddy. You don't pay
right.
much attention to what they do. But he would cry, and every time he would see her, he'd give her a big hug and say, thank you, just thank you. And that was in 2006, then he came back in 2000, and I believe it was 17 and 18, or whether 16 and 18, but three times after that, and he would sit on the porch with her for the brief time that he could and just, you know, hug her, hold her hand, and tell her how thankful
wow.
He was, because she was beginning to battle with Alzheimer's. So a lot of things she was forgetful, but she never forgot him. And the name, and she would hug him, and it just to watch them embrace each other was so rewarding. So she passed in September of 2019, and the last time he came this way was in March of 2020, and he definitely would have gone by to see her if she was still alive. But he did send a letter when she was buried for her funeral. He sent a beautiful letter, again, thanking her that we put in a frame for her.
I asked you about your... Was it your uncle that had the restaurant that would feed them? How did they do that? Tell them what do you remember about the days that they were at the house? What was that like for you as a 13-year-old? Other than watching the college boys, as you said in the interview, what was that like to watch what was going on?
Just watching it, the house is big. You have to really come in. As I said, it's called the Harris House, and we're pretty much opening up for museums so people can get the experience of what I'm saying to you now. But the house is relatively large, so you had them pretty much roaming around the house. They could be in the kitchen, or they could be in that upstairs room where most of the pictures were taken and the strategy sessions were made. But they would sit on these kitchen stools, the bar stools, that came out of my dad's lunch counter. So we had the stools and the grill and the Coca-Cola box, and the jukebox, with everything. So it was very easy to accommodate everyone. And my uncle had a restaurant that was right next door to my dad's drugstore. His nickname was Pick, P-I-C, Pick's Restaurant, but his name was William Washington. And he provided all of the food. And one of the main dishes that they all remember was the spaghetti. And you can see pictures on Getty Image of them eating the spaghetti dinners on a, sitting at the counter. But that was just one of the major dishes. But you had they played cards. They danced during some of the downtime. They liked to play with my younger brothers at that time because they had two younger brothers and one that was only 4 years old. And they would joke around with them. So, it was fun. It was like people just being in your house.
Yeah.
We, as children, were never part of the strategies and the seriousness of what was going on. But during the downtime, it was very social. And you'd watch them watching the news a lot so that they could keep abreast of what was going on.
Now, you jumped out there yourself and went on one or two of these marches, too, apparently, as I recall.
Oh, yes. Well, when you're 13, ending the eighth grade, about to go to the ninth grade, and, as I said, we've been already watching this through and being a participant, even as children, through Montgomery bus boycott and then all of the protests coming from Alabama State University campus, which comes straight past us. But then watching the Freedom Riders and watching how these students operate, by the time I got to ninth grade, it's 62 and then 63 at events in Birmingham, but you've got all these little protests going on. So we are being trained now by the SNCC people that are in town, and they are recruiting high school students so that you can train them on how to fall, how to sit on a bus or stool, how not to react. These kinds of things. So you're getting strong and going to all of the mass meetings. And so by the time 1964 comes and the Civil Rights Bill is passed, I'm coming out of 11th grade going into 12th grade, and we're ready to test the waters before the ink is dry. That was that July, and so we're testing movie theaters and restaurants and, water fountains and anything that we could not participate in before, knowing that we are going to be accosted, which we were, but you still did it. You just did it because you could do it, and you were determined to do it. You're not going to push us back. No, we're not going backwards. We will literally die for this cause. So that was the feeling that you had.
Dr. Montgomery, what if now the congressman is back in Atlanta? Tomorrow there'll be a final service, and they'll be laid to rest next to his wife, Lillian. What is your enduring memory, either back then or in recent years, of John Lewis and who he was to you and to your family and just to history?
To me, first of all, to describe him from a personal standpoint, is I will always remember his warmth and his humility, his extremely humble and loving personality from his civil rights and his professional responsibilities, I should say. It was his determination and his dedication to being a committed for the cause. And I just 100% understand that feeling. In fact, one of my favorite songs during the movement was Keep On Pushing by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions. Yeah. And that seems to be one of his mottos of just keep pushing forward. And that's what you have to do. You've got to keep moving forward. And because movement is what's going to create the change.
Is that a website or a Facebook page? You said the home is now open. Are y'all doing public tours or selected tours?
Yes. We were all set to open up and really start doing this when COVID hit.
Okay.
So that's put a damper in it. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's designed literally for what we call educational tourism.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for instance, if you had a small group that you wanted to hold sessions in and let them really experience what that was like,
right.
Those are the kinds of things that we're doing. But it's on the Dr. Richard Harris House, if you kind of, Richard Harris House or Google it. Something will come up for you. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Montgomery, thank you so much. You know you're my new best friend now.
All right, you got to come on by.
I got to meet you. Your spirit is just incredible. I've been smiling from ear to ear since we talked because you have so much. I witnessed the history. And look, as soon as this blow over, I'm coming to Montgomery to walk through the house and let you tell the story, okay?
You do that. You do that. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for the invite.
You are so welcome. Bless you, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thank you. Right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Look here, we got to take a break. We'll be back with more. Coming up next is Tom Houck, and we'll figure out how this white soul brother was just a foot soldier to the movement, ends up being the driver for statesman, the friend. Probably, you know, I try to think of somebody, knowing John the way I did, whose company he enjoyed more. I don't know of a person. Tom Houck is, one of those staples or entity. If you ever met the dude, you fall in love with him instantly. He has this infectious smile. He has the charm of a Sunday school choir boy, but cuss like a sailor, and that's why I like him so. I'm just kidding about that part. Tom, how you doing, man? I know that this is a tough, because whenever your birthday was or John's birthday was, or that was a big election, big event, election night, I saw your picture. I don't know if it was on your poster somewhere. You were a journalist on the radio here in the city, all black, jet black, brownish hair, brownish beard and everything. And so I said, I know that's been a long time ago. How you doing, brother?
Well, you know, it's been rough. I've known John since 1965. I was working at the time for, SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And, I happened to meet John, and then not too long after, I was working with Jose, actually, at the time, getting into good trouble.
Right.
It was an occasion in Atlanta where I was driving for Dr. King. And
first of all, I know I got to slow you down, because when you've been there, it's easy history, but you got to tell the story how you actually end up being a white driver in 1965. For Dr. King, you're a young white guy. First of all, tell us, how did you come to the movement, Tom?
Well, since I was 12 years old, had this commitment for social justice, equality, ending racism.
Right.
And I went to Selma, actually. I was in high school, and I got kicked out of high school for going to Selma. And Selma was actually, this was after John and Jose led the march across the bridge, but I went there to support the march to Montgomery. And so I got involved with SCLC at that time with Jose and started working for SCLC, Birmingham and other places. Birmingham was like Birmingham too, trying to get federal registrars. And John and I just sort of became friends.
Yeah.
And I met Julian Bond along the same time. Of course, Julian and John were very close friends. And I, perhaps more than anything else, remember was that John was, to me, okay, when I first met him, and he had just left SNCC. That's, for those who don't know, that's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And Stokely had taken over. And John was getting ready to go to New York to work for the Field Foundation. But we remained friends, and he would come back to Atlanta. And then, of course, he came back here permanently to head up the Voter Education Project, which I worked for him for 2 years. But going back to how I became Dr. King's accidental driver, we were in Birmingham, and Dr. King had come over to Birmingham to congratulate us on a victory getting the federal registrars in Birmingham. This was after the Voting Rights Act. And he said he needed someone to answer mail, and I raised my hand, and Dr. King said, Tom, I heard they kicked you out of high school. You haven't finished high school. How are you going to answer my mail? And I said, well, I can answer your mail. I'm a good writer. So I came to Atlanta, took a bus from Birmingham over here, and I was in front of SCLC's office waiting to go. We used to have old freedom houses in Atlanta, Derek. One was SNCC's Freedom House, which is now on John Wesley Dobbs, and Dr. King's old house was torn down to build a Freedom Parkway. Which was not then, it was going to be interstate. But anyway, I was waiting in front of SCLC. Dr. King had just finished preaching at Ebenezer, and he was driving down the street with the kids and Coretta. They were heading over to their house, and he said, Tom, you need a ride to the Freedom House? And I said, yeah, I really would. So I got in the car. He put Bernice back in the back seat, and Coretta and I and Martin were all sitting up front. And he said, have you had lunch yet? And I said, no, I haven't. He said, he invited me. Here I am. You know, an 18-year-old white boy with a big black sort of a shaggy hair and a beard. And here I am going to Dr. King's house, you know, for lunch.
Now, is this the Sunset House at that time?
Oh, yeah, the Sunset House. He moved, he moved there in 1964.
Right.
And then he gave up his house on Johnson Avenue, which was torn down, to FCLC. And that became the Freedom House, which Jose was in charge of. Because Jose was his field director. And
tell us, John, tell us, man, I got to get you. I really got, we've been saying, I got to just get you when I got you. Tell people what the Freedom House was. What did that mean? What that, what was that house looking like?
Right, the Freedom House, SNCC and FCLC had places where people who were the foot soldiers came back to town, like for FCLC, J.T. Johnson, Ben Clark.
You didn't have to rent a hotel or anything.
Right, Cleveland Sellers, for, you know, with SNCC and, you know, Ruby Doris Robinson, who, by the way, is a cousin to our current mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms. But it would stay at these houses. We would come back sort of to get away from the hectic battles of getting your head beaten in and going to jail. In Albany, Georgia, and, you know, Biloxi, Mississippi, and what have you.
Wow.
And he would come back in. And it was sort of both strategizing, relaxing, and taking easy. So there was two Freedom Houses here. And the old SNCC house is now an affluent hip chicoisie house that has been turned into what a lot of the old Fourth Ward has been turned into.
Certainly.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And so that these houses, so we were back and forth all the time, the SCLC and SNCC people. And actually, Stokely lived in the house for a while after he became chairman of SNCC. And I'm trying to get the city to put a marker up over there in front of this house that now is probably worth $1.5 million.
They probably won't let you. The gentrified
won't let
you.
Well, I talked to the woman. She said she wouldn't mind.
All right. Well, Michael Jr. to make that happen. He's going to be coming up in a little bit. Look, Tom, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want you to talk about meeting John and over the years, how y'all's relationship transformed.
Okay.
Because I knew that John had made his transition by watching my Facebook timeline and saw your post, which probably came about an hour before the official announcement.
Oh, I was long before Facebook with John.
Yeah, you didn't say much. And you said, I just
There wasn't just Facebook back when John and I met.
I'm talking about your Facebook just recently when John
transitioned.
Yeah, you didn't say much, but we kind of knew. Oh, okay. But when we come back, we'll talk to Tom Hauk. Tom Hauk is a guest.
He's a mom and gay.
Developer. Yeah, and man, that song does it every time out the racks. You and John become close. Y'all shared a lot together. Tell us how the friendship just turned into this camaraderie and mutual respect for each other.
Well, After Dr. King was assassinated, we had the Four People's Campaign that continued, and I worked with Bernard Lafayette and several people organizing minority groups. And what happened was, I had to make a decision when I was going to stay with SCLC. Abernathy had taken over at that point. Mm-hmm. And John had just come back to Atlanta and set up, became the head of the Voter Education Project. Mm-hmm. And he offered me a job. It paid better than SCLC, I must tell you. But that's not the reason. What we were going to do is we're going to do these mass mobilizations across the South to register people to vote. Mm-hmm. And so in 1969, I started working for John at the Voter Education Project, and we became real close friends with he. And, of course, everything John did, he did with Lillian. Lillian was his girlfriend and his wife. I was at their wedding. And, but it became a very strong relationship. And also, I must say, it became a very strong relationship with Julian as well.
Yeah.
And I would do the tours across the South for them. I'd be like the advance man going into places like Hattiesburg and Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, and over to Louisiana, Bogalusa, and South Georgia, all across the South. John VEP probably registered more people to vote between 1969 and 1972 than anybody ever in the South. And with Julian, we did these caravans into three or four, maybe five churches in different towns a day. And it created a phenomenal bond with us. And John would call me every day back in those days to wake me up. Mr. Ha, it's time to get up now. You got to get up. It's a full day. And I'd say, okay. I'd say, all right. And then, that relationship continued. We probably talked 10,000 times between 1969 and until 3 weeks ago. And Bill Campbell, former Mayor Bill Campbell, I guess many mm-hmm. people know who he is, my great friend, became, very much a part of that when he and John became colleagues at the city council, mm-hmm. and he was in the same office with John. But John and I not only shared birthdays, but we shared a complete friendship. I mean, it was nothing like it. I mean, it's just tearing me apart that I'm not going to have John waking me up mm-hmm. in the morning anymore. It's an incredible, the world that he helped build and what he did. Mm-hmm. Now, in the race for Congress, it really tore me up, but I was doing talk radio and WGST in those days when it was real talk radio. And we did the debate, at City Hall, the old City Hall chambers, with Julian and John. Mm-hmm. And of course, these are two of my best friends. I tried to stay out of it. Lillian thought I was leaning towards Julian, but at any rate, so it was the only time in my life with John since 1969 that we had a period where we didn't actually talk for a while. But we mended fences.
Yeah.
I tried to get Julian to mend fences with John, which was a very hard thing to do after that battle.
Right.
But John, would consult with me about what he was doing and how he was doing it. And then when he went to Congress, of course, I went up there. He invited me, and I went to when Barack Obama gave him the Medal of Freedom. I was one of the six people from Atlanta there.
Wow.
And then Lillian would give me her passes to go to the State of the Union address, the first mm-hmm. one by Bill Clinton, two under Bill Clinton, actually. It was that kind of relationship. And I was here from John Miles Lewis since he was, first came into the Lewis household as a young baby. I really became part of the family. We would share occasions together, go there for Thanksgiving, and, we would spend, a lot of time at Christmas together.
Yeah.
And, it was through thick and thin, we were strong. And that was my buddy. And it was a wonderful way. It was wonderful to see all the things that John mm-hmm. accomplished in life, and how he did it. And to me, it's not only a tremendous loss for Atlanta and for the 5th Congressional District, but the Congress as well, the world as well. Because John was a man of the people, not only here, but around the world.
Yeah. Tell us about the John Lewis, the behind the scene, to the extent that you can and willing to share. What did he like to do? What was his favorite food? Music connoisseur?
A collector of black art, African art. He has a phenomenal collection, not only here, but in his house in Washington. He loved to go to galleries and see what was, see what artists was there. And he was actually into the performing arts, very much so. And so was it Lillian, his wife.
Yeah.
But what was he like? Well, Lillian used to call us like leaky refrigerators because she said that we like to gossip all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is true.
Right.
But Lillian liked to gossip too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like John was funny and witty in his own way.
Right.
Like it was a thunderstorm outside, even when you had your cell phone, you wouldn't get off the cell phone because he was worried the lightning was going to strike.
That's old school.
Yeah, old school, right. You got it. Very old school. And, there's so many stories that I could talk to you about, the anecdotes I could talk to you about with John. And last time I saw him was 2 weeks ago, on Sunday 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I knew that, he did not have very much longer to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, John, and he looked at me, his eyes halfway open. He said, yes. And I said, John, this is Tom. And he said, I know. and then it was like, I said, we're going to beat Trump. And he said, we got to.
We got to.
We got to.
He was a man in full. We got just about a minute or so. What will you miss most about your friend? What would you want the world to know about John Robert Lewis that we might not know? If you were delivering the eulogy tomorrow in Ebenezer, what would you say to people about your friend?
Soul force. That he was a man of tremendous compassion, of justice, of doing the right thing, of making sure other people did. He didn't let one day go by where he was not a force to be reckoned with. That he had developed himself not only the conscience of Congress, but he had become, in the new wonderful movement that has been created in this country, unfortunately came on the heels of the death of George Floyd, but he has become a new hero again to a new generation. And we're going to continue to see that happen.
People will
know more about John Lewis in the weeks and months and years to come than they knew about him before.
One of the last places he wanted to make sure that one of his last photographs that was made available public was him standing in the Black Lives Matter Square
Plaza
in Washington. What do you think he was thinking about in that moment as he stood there looking the White House in front of him, history behind him, mortality right in his front at his feet? What do you think he was contemplating or reflecting upon?
Well, we talked that afternoon. He had just told me that he might go over there, and then they went over there around 6 o'clock in the morning when the mayor had invited him, Michael Collins, who's John's chief of staff, and coordinated it. I talked to him in the afternoon, and he said it was just unbelievable. He said it was absolutely unbelievable, a great, great thing to have happened. And he said it was one of the best memories he'll ever have in his life.
He was proud of what the young people are doing out here, huh?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He wants to, John was only 23 when he spoke at the March on Washington.
Right.
And he was only 21 when he was elected chairman of SNCC. he can relate to these kids and this new generation out there on the streets.
All right.
Because that's what he was.
Right. Tom Hawk, thank you so much, man. I know COVID, I know you're not doing it. Are you doing, obviously not doing tours now, I don't think.
No, I'm doing Civil Rights Tour Atlanta, though, is up on my website, and you can get information. We're going to start doing tours, I hope, in the near future when science and the conditions, you know, make it happen. You know, there I mean, you know. I can't put people on a bus and, you know, being in a dangerous situation. But I am going to be at the service tomorrow.
All right. Tom Howell, we love you, man.
I love you too, Derek.
Man, we appreciate you more than you would know. You have lived this history, and you've been the kind of ally and the friend to progressive politics that we need. Of his good friends is none other than Atlanta Mayor William Craig Campbell. Bill Campbell, how are you doing, brother?
Well, Derek, it's a bittersweet moment because John was such a dear friend and a colleague and such a giant person in history. And I am delighted that America is finally recognizing the incredible achievements that John brought to this country and made America a better place. But on a personal level, it's just very difficult to say goodbye.
I was in y'all's presence a lot. Because we go to ceremony, we go to official event. You and I serve together. I serve a portion of your term as mayor, your second term, worked in city government before that. And so, as I said, we would go different places. And anywhere where you saw John, you would say the boy from Troy. He would kind of laugh. And I didn't. You know, I never told you this, but I was like, it made me feel uncomfortable until I learned what the reference came from and why it made him just bust out with a big smile. Tell us about, obviously you knew the story that I did know. You referred to him as the boy from Troy because that's how Dr. King called him when he first met. Tell us that story and why he would always get a kick out of you saying that to him.
One of the most incredible stories about history and how history is made, Derek, think about this. John Lewis was 15 years old. Think about how we are at 15. He was 15 years old.
Yeah.
He wrote a letter to Dr. King telling him that he had not been given admission to Troy State. He could not accept the status quo, and he had heard Dr. King preach over the radio, and he wanted to be a part of this movement for justice. And out of nowhere, Dr. King not only wrote him a letter, but sent him a bus ticket. And think about
right.
this. And John, at 15, got on a bus from outside of Troy, Alabama, and went to meet Dr. King. And he tells the story. He walked in, 15 years old. There was Dr. King, one of the most famous civil rights figures, Ralph David Abernathy. And Dr. King said, "Are you the boy from Troy?" And he said, "I'm John Robert Lewis." And he said after that, everywhere he went, Dr. King would always say, "The boy from Troy." And it was such a term of endearment that John loved it, and it felt so close. And I will tell you, you know, other than Ralph David Abernathy Sr., I don't know if anybody was closer to Dr. King than John Lewis. And Andy Young and John Lewis and Dr. Abernathy, what a quartet of historical figures.
Yeah.
And, you know, John was such a youngster. But I was with, I'll tell you this, Derek. I took Andy Young over to see John in the last week of his life. And Andy told John how he had been moved to get involved in the civil rights movement by watching John Lewis on television from New York. And he and Gene packed up all of their belongings and moved down to Georgia in order to be a part of it because they saw what John Lewis and Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy and C.T. Vivian were doing. And history was made. And so when we see John Lewis being celebrated as one of the great figures in history, it just tells you, and I've said this before, Derek, it says that no matter how small you are, how much you feel unimportant, think about what John Lewis was able to do from Troy, Alabama, the son of sharecroppers, and he became one of the great figures of history. It's a great story about dedication and commitment and courage. And I will tell you, when they write history,
yeah,
they will talk about Gandhi and King and Mandela and John Lewis. And I think that says so much about this giant of a man.
Y'all got history that go back 1981, 82. You all served together, I believe, on the city council.
We ran together. It was a crazy story, Derek.
Hold the story, because I want, when we come back, you and John were some real rebels. Important issue comes up. You're a young council member, represent District 2, which had some of the biggest communities and portions of downtown in it. And they get ready for the Presidential Parkway. We have a returning president who want to build his library, and they want to drive a parkway straight through communities. Andy Young was for it. I think John opposed. I think you were too. I'll let you tell the story of, because they kept going back to John, asking him, would you change your mind? He would never change. So tell us a little bit of that story. And because people forget that John actually served on the city council from 81 to 86, I believe it was. And when we come back, I want you to tell us about your city council days with John Lewis. Franklin, John really did believe a better world was possible. And he really did internalize do no harm. Unmerited suffering is redemptive. He believed that to the core of his being. It wasn't strategy for him. It was very real.
You know, it's hard to imagine, Derek, because so much of what we know today in terms of sacrifice does not equate to the kind of commitment and dedication and sacrifice that John gave for all of us. I've said before, think about this. Commitment is getting on the bus as a freedom rider.
Right.
After they set the bus on fire and blocked the door and then beat them when they were able to finally get off the bus, courage is then getting back on the bus
and
riding again.
Knowing you're finna get beat again. Mm-hmm.
And they did get beat again.
Yeah.
That's courage. And that was just a part of his incredible sacrifice for all of us.
Yeah.
Then there is the Edmund Pettus Bridge a few years later and a host of other times. And the story that he told Derek about when they left him in the middle of the night with several other freedom riders, and they knew they were going to be killed by the Klansmen. They would be left there, and they managed to go through the cotton fields and find a little house to shelter them. I mean, this is history that is for us to be here today.
Right.
And I can't tell you how pleased I am to see the incredible outpouring of love and appreciation for John.
Yeah.
So I was running for city council in 1981. John was my campaign chairperson. And then everyone began persuading John, well, if Bill's going to run, you should run also, John, because then we'll have a whole new council. And so John ran, and we ran together, and we won, and then we shared an office for 5 years until he was able to run and become the congressman for 1986. So we shared so many memories, so much of the life that I really know in Atlanta is because of what John Lewis was able to bring for all of us. And I just can never say enough about what a wonderful human being. And not the historic, monumental civil rights figure,
certainly,
Derek, but the most humble, gentle, thoughtful man who was so kind and considerate to everyone that he met. You cannot find a person to say anything negative about John Lewis. They might not have agreed with his philosophy or his politics, but never in terms of his principles. He was just the most wonderful human being. And I, as I've said before, I don't know that we will ever see anyone like John Lewis ever again. And what an honor and privilege to have been a part of his life for the last 40 years.
Talk about the Presidential Parkway vote. That was,
you know, the Presidential Parkway is an interesting thing, Derek, because when John and I were elected, I represented all of the areas, Old Fourth Ward, Bedford Pine, Inman Park, Posse Highlands, and it was not going to be a, look, just let me start, let me back up for a second. Mm-hmm. Everywhere in America, they have taken black communities and split them right down the middle and put highways.
Certainly.
And they don't care, and they didn't care, and it was going to be the same dynamic with the road going from downtown all the way out to Stone Mountain. And it was going to slice through Old Fourth Ward and Bedford Pine and a host of other black communities, as well as Inman Park and Posse Highlands. And John Lewis and Myrtle Davis and Thomas Cuffey and myself, we were part of the new council. Mm-hmm. And everybody was against us. The governor, Joe Frank Harris, Mayor Andrew Young, the commissioner of transportation, Tom Moreland, as well as the former president, Jimmy Carter, because they wanted to be able to honor Jimmy Carter appropriately. But we knew that their objective wasn't to honor President Carter.
Mm-hmm.
It was to put a highway through those communities. And we fought it. And John was, you know, it's funny how when you've got someone that's as courageous as John standing up for principles, it's a lot easier to sort of stand beside him because knowing what he had already endured in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave us the strength to be able to continue to fight it. And now you have this wonderfully landscaped parkway as opposed to a highway that would have destroyed East Atlanta. And I think that just speaks about, again, when you're talking about issues that are monumental, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, the civil rights legislation. But on a local level, John was also as principled as any person that I've ever known.
Yeah. Your last visit or your last time you were able to just have a real conversation with him, what was he thinking about? What was he looking forward to? What was he projecting from that time forward?
John and Tom Houkel, you had on earlier, and I would spend hours on the phone talking about politics and how we could make America better through political involvement and through changing the status quo. And he would just talk for hours about what we could do and how we could do it. And so the last conversation that we had were during the election. And we talked about it. And then, you know, John was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and it just weakened him, as you can imagine. My mother died from stage 4 pancreatic cancer, Derek. And here's the other thing that's interesting. It disproportionately affects African Americans.
Yep.
They don't know why. They don't know what the factors are. They don't know what the reasons are. But it disproportionately affects African Americans, and it is a deadly, insidious disease.
Yeah.
And when they told us that John had been diagnosed around Thanksgiving, it just changed the dynamic. But I'll say this: he never was asked for a pity.
Right.
He stayed strong until the very end. And here's one thing I want everyone to understand: John's body was ravaged by cancer, and he managed to get up and go out and stand in the Black Lives Plaza in Washington, D.C., the last public appearance that he made there, in order to show solidarity with these young people who have changed America. And I will tell you, he was so proud of them, and he wanted them to know that he supported them and what they had done. And he just was so moved by the same sort of protest that he had done in an earlier iteration of his life. And the last few weeks when he had returned to Atlanta, Derek, it was just very difficult because his body was failing and it was frail. We would go and sit with him and talk to him and tell him how much we loved him and appreciated him. And his great people in America would call President Obama, Vice President Biden, Speaker Pelosi, Oprah Winfrey and Gayle King called, the whining sang to him over the phone. And, you know, I think he was at peace with the transition.
Yeah.
that he was that we knew was certain to come, Derek. But I will say I was honored to be a part of his life, and America is a better place for the work and the sacrifice that John Lewis made. And I don't know that we will ever have the occasion to know someone that was literally willing to give their life in order to make America a better place.
William Craig Campbell, thank you, man. Thank you for all that you have done. I was talking about you a couple weeks ago. I said if this city was anything, that would be banners hung with your picture on it for what you meant to communities in the redevelopment of this city. And at some point, history is going to get it right. Thank you for being my friend down through the years and for just calling, checking up for those text messages that come sometime and from those little talks about politics that we have. Thank you for the sacrifice, because we know the history. Yours was not too much different from John. Your mom and dad was in the movement, and you integrated the schools down in North Carolina, Raleigh. And so thank you, man, for all that your family has meant and what you mean. If you don't hear it enough, brother, I want you to know publicly, and you hear it from me, we love you, man, for all that you have meant to this city and all that you continue to mean to so many of us who understands how this thing works, man. All right?
Thank you, my friend. And you know, love is the answer. And I appreciate the love that I've received from the people of Atlanta. Let me tell you, it's the greatest honor of my life to have been elected mayor of Atlanta. No thing can ever express how deeply appreciative I am of the people of Atlanta for giving me the opportunity to lead this great city. And I thank you for your kind words, Derek.
All right, my brother, take care. I know you all headed off golfing if you ain't already been today. Perhaps no family was closely tied together, more closely tied together than in history than the Bond and Lewis family. We have on the phone with us my good friend, brother, colleague, street running partner, Michael Julian Bond. Michael, how are you?
Derek, I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
Man, anytime I can hear from you is a good thing. Douglas High Astro.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Talk about John Lewis. You can talk about him perhaps like none other can, because him and your daddy kind of came to the movement together. They started in SNCC and started early. We hear John starting at 15, 16. My earliest memory of your dad, he was always there in the movement, put out of the state house, nominated from the Democratic floor to be vice president, was too young to serve. I think he may have been 32 or something, 30, when he was 30. Right. And I know your fondest memory, when you knew your dad was a big shot, he hosted Saturday Night Live. I know that's one of your great memories of Julian Bond. Talk about these two men and how y'all families were tied together.
Thank you, Derek, for having me. And, you know, we always want to extend condolences to the Lewis family, particularly John Miles. But, you know, they met in February 1960. At the conference that was called to form the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was originally conceived to be a student arm of SELC, but they quickly assumed their own independence of action and how they would, you know, conduct themselves in movement activities around the country. You know, John was based out of Alabama. Like I say, he became active around 15. And my dad and Amos Brown, famous pastor from the West Coast, they were NAACP Youth Council members. So they got involved when they were around 14, 15 years old. But in 1960, SNCC was forming. They met and they just became, you know, fast friends. They were best friends. You know, his wife, Lillian, mm-hmm. and John were my godparents, mm-hmm. and extended godparents to my other siblings. You know, my dad, my mother, Lillian were close friends, and we did everything together. We ate together, we vacationed together, we hung out together, went to the movies together, socialized together. They had birthday parties for us at their house, you know, vice versa. You know, so, I mean, they were extremely close and really the best of friends. I remember as a child that they were referred to as the civil rights twins.
Yeah.
You know, because they were so close and they were so aligned in their philosophy and, mm-hmm. And in their politics. I mean, they were virtually identical, you know, in their beliefs.
I saw some file footage. I don't know if it was off your page, off another, because a lot of stuff is coming forth, where they're in either the Mississippi Delta or somewhere, knocking on doors, go door to door. And they looked so young, right? Because they were. And they were like the dynamic duo. John
right.
would say hello, and then your dad would go in there for the closer, and they were registering people to vote. And they registered tons and tons of black people to vote now. And talking about like we doing now, because you and I came of a very privileged generation. But these, to be doing that was very dangerous. It was dangerous work because Medgar killed, registering people. Talk about that. What did you ever get a sense from your dad and from John that the work was really as dangerous as we now know it was?
Well, yes, because around that time when they were traveling the South together, John, you know, had been forced out of the leadership of SNCC as chairman, and he formed the Voter Education Project. And so he and Daddy would go around, as you characterize it, into the harshest, deepest, mm-hmm. darkest, most dangerous parts of the South to register people to vote. And, you know, as kids, as rambunctious as we were, there were times, you know, John didn't drive. So when we would, you know, our families would get together or we would hang out, often my dad would drive John, you know, where he had to go or where they were going together. And, you know, we would be alone in the backseat of the car. You know, back then, no seat belts, just jumping and bouncing around.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father had to remind us over and over again how John had been injured, how he had been hurt, because he would get these tremendous migraines, almost unbidden.
Wow.
From his injuries, you know. And so there were times when we were having a good time, having fun, and John would just retreat because, you know, a headache would come on to him. And, you know, they would describe the work that they were doing as best they could to, you know, kids of our age. And, of course, we received a lot of death threats. John received death threats for the work that they were doing. So we were always worried and cognizant of how dangerous it was. And, of course, we lived two houses down from, you know, Martin, Bunny, mm-hmm. Jackson, King. And we were always aware that they had lost their father doing this kind of work.
Right.
And so we felt blessed that we still had ours.
All right. Look, we got to take a little break, and I'm going to throw Mukasa in here to tell us about the SNCC days. And then, Mike, just tell us your fondest memory. We all know about the election. I ain't going to even go tread over all of that. Unless you want to just tell us what that was like. It was a bitter election. John emerged as the congressman. And your dad go on to do what he do so well. He became a college professor and spent the balance of his days teaching, for the most part, at American University. But I tell you, when I was an aide to Senator Lankford, and I would often be in the hall and see your dad when he was a state senator. And I remember seeing him being interviewed or somebody trying to throw him a curveball. And I just watched Junior. I say, this is the most brilliant mind that I ever seen. I just never seen anybody with a mind this quick, because he put them folks in their place fast. But you, your family, at some point I got really to have you on too, to just tell your family story, because you come from a long line. The man and the bond side of the family, from college presidents to university leaders, and you know, a great pantheon of people of substance. You had one picture in your office. Was that your grandfather? Who was that with Einstein, sitting down teaching Einstein?
That was my grandfather, Dr. Horace Mann Bond, who at that time was president of Lincoln University.
Yeah.
And they invited Einstein to come and to receive an honorary degree. And he actually taught a seminar on his theory of relativity at that time it was all men at Lincoln University. And, you know, Einstein was discriminated against because before then, even though he had done so much for the world with his theories and for the country, he rarely got invited to majority institutions because he was Jewish.
Right.
But after that, you know, he would, after Lincoln presented him with an award, that kind of thawed.
Right.
And can you imagine that they were discriminating against Einstein all over this? You know.
But your granddad said, come on up here to Lincoln and sit down with our boys up here.
And, right, and they
teach them
maintained a relationship after that until Einstein's death.
Right.
And, you know, my father actually got to interact with Einstein as a child. And,
all right.
You know, like that, yeah.
We'll tell a little bit about that. And as we get ready to close out, we'll bring Mukasa in here. And, again, our special guest, talk to a number of people who worked directly with him, doing well. Michael Julian, what do you remember most about John Lewis? What is your greatest memory of him?
Well, John was always just so loving and kind. And, you know, as my godfather, I mean, they spoiled us with love and care. But I have a light story that I like to tell about once John took us to the Braves game. I guess I was about 8 years old, and he was taking my younger brother Jeffrey and I to a Braves game. Of course, he didn't drive. My dad had to go and pick him up. And so when we went to get him, he had a big Rich's shopping bag. You know, of course, everybody who's from Atlanta knows, remember those big white paper bags with Rich's across the bottom. And Derek, I tell you, this, he had made, you know, we thought we were going to the game to get popcorn, drinks, you know, foot long dogs. Don had actually sat down. Cooked all these hot dogs himself, and then wrapped them in foil, you know, and got his own, you know, own Coke and drinks. And,
I bet y'all said, "Man, Daddy, where did Country Bumpkin come from? These wrapped up hot dogs and everything."
Well, I will say we were crestfallen with our expectations. And of course, John had on a suit, you know, so he picked him up.
Are you kidding?
No, he had on a suit, and so we went down. Yeah, he was fully dressed, and so we went down to Fulton County Stadium.
That's hilarious.
I tell you, Derek, I'm a big baseball fan, but
yeah, I know
that day, that game is probably the most favorite experience I've ever had at a baseball game, and
with
we
your
did
hot dog wrapped up in a bun, your little ketchup and mustard brought in a Rich's shopping bag.
In a Rich's shopping bag, you know, it was made with care. And
there you go. Hang on with him, Mike. We get ready to get off here anyway. Mukasa, how are you, African?
I'm doing great, thank you.
African, how you doing?
Hey, brother African, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great.
Mukasa, you know you're one of my favorite people because you were right there with the man who I just credit so much of who I am. Arthur Langford got shot with him at Holy Family Hospital. But we ain't got but a few minutes, but I could not end this broadcast without having you say something about John, because you were there. These were the SNCC, the early days. Tell us about the John Lewis that you met and that you knew when you first met him. And there will come a time where you and Stokely and others were, y'all like, hey, we ain't so much wedded to this nonviolent, all this just nice stuff. But there's a beautiful picture. There have been some beautiful pictures emerging of you, John, you, Dr. King. You got the one on the march, but there's some others that you're very much in the background of that I have not seen. And I've been knowing you more than over half of my life. Talk about John Lewis, the John Lewis you organized with. And when was the most dangerous time of march that you all were together?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm one of the only people that really know John Lewis. when I was in Chattanooga with C.T. Vivian, when I was a young man, I was up. We had a civil rights demonstration. They attacked them. We threw bricks and balls. So SCLC and the NAACP and all of them rushed up there to talk to me and the others about nonviolence. And C.T. and I worked together. He was so impressed with me. When the movement started getting started in Atlanta, C.T. called Dr. King. Dr. King said I was too militant the way C.T. even described me to him. He called John Lewis and Jim Foreman them. And John Lewis sent me a ticket to Atlanta to come join SNCC. And the first assignment I got was from Julian Bond. And that was to lick stamps. I licked 1,000 stamps and I was drunk. and secondly, John Lewis was a member of a strong organization called SNCC. It was the people in there that was strong. And we made Marion Barry our first chairman, and then Chuck McGoo, and then John Lewis. And John Lewis faced the sit-ins, the freedom riots. We went into Mississippi and we started working on voter registration to vote all these evil white folks out of office. And when we started doing that, they burnt down churches like in Lee County, Georgia. They burnt down churches. They burnt in Mississippi. They burnt down under John Lewis' leadership about 70 churches in 1964.
Wow.
They killed workers working with John Lewis, Cheney, Swan, and Goodman. And then in 1965, John Lewis and myself, Jim Foreman, and others went to the United Nations, kicked the door down at the South African Embassy, and told them to end that apartheid down there and free Nelson Mandela and Robert Sood Bugwe. And John Lewis spoke out for South Africa. We won the first to do it. And then the next year, they killed Sammy Young Jr., a student in Tuskegee, for going into a bathroom that said white only. And when they killed him, we made a press conference. Julian Bond, all of us there. And we said if a black man can go and fight in the Army, he had been in the Navy, if you can go fight in the Army and then come back and can't piss behind a white man, we ain't got no business in the Army, and therefore we opposed the war in Vietnam. And John Lewis was one of the first people to oppose the war in Vietnam, and it scared Martin King. It scared NAACP and all these other little politicians they had. They didn't want us to speak out against Vietnam, but we did. And then by 1965, we organized the Black Panther Party under John Lewis' leadership. And then by 1966, we had a meeting and we voted John Lewis out because we say that his style of leadership was no longer militant enough for SNCC. And when we voted him out, we voted Stokely Carmichael in. And we voted Stokely Carmichael in during the same year. Julian Bond, and we exposed Atlanta. They're keeping it a secret that blacks was a majority in Atlanta. So when we exposed that, we ran Julian Bond and about four other people, Hood and Ben Brown and four other people in office, and they won. And when Julian Bond won, at the press conference John Lewis we had, said we opposed the war in Vietnam. They asked Julian, did you agree with that? Julian said, yes, I agree with it. And that's when they kicked him out of the legislature. And when they kicked him out as legislator, we built a movement around it. But I would also like to say that little maid lady that be down in the City Hall, Miss Bolton.
Yeah, Dorothy Bolton.
Dorothy
Bond ran for office in West Vine City. She was the voice of Vine City. And she would stand up and say, Junior couldn't speak. He didn't speak. He's a quiet little guy. And she would stand up and say, y'all vote for Julian. He's a good boy. He's a good boy. I want all y'all to vote for Julian.
I'm Mukasa, and look, man, we out of time. I got to have y'all back. We done had way too much fun, and this is way too much history.
I know Julian Bond, and I know John Lewis. And one last point I want to make, when Julian couldn't speak, I was the one that spoke for him, and Julian would get up and say, thank you very much, and that was his speech.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.